today's episode of the Sixers Beat, Rich and I talk about the fact that the Sixers were the top-ranked defense in the month of November, how to reconcile that with the fact that they got lit up by the Cleveland Cavaliers on Wednesday night, whether there are any long-term concerns from that performance against the Cavs. We then talk about how Joel Embiid has looked in his return to play, and how the Sixers should tailor their offense now that they have their centerpiece back. Enjoy the podcast. All right, welcome everybody. This is Derek Bodner, joined by Rich Hoffman on the Sixers Beat, a part of the Athletics Podcast Network. How you doing, Rich?
Derek, I'm doing fine. I got nothing really else to say about that, so let's get into it.
It's about how the Sixers are doing. They've had some ups and downs. A blowout win over the Magic since our last podcast. Now a blowout loss here to the Cavs with a good win. Neither a blowout in either direction, but a good win against the Atlanta Hawks. I guess rather than talk about any one specifically, at least start off, I'm sure we'll get into specifics. What's sort of been your overall takeaway here in the three games since we last spoke, or at least since we last spoke on a podcast format?
Well, Joel Embiid is back.
He is.
It's kind of noticeable when that happens.
He does tend to leave his imprint on the game, yeah.
He's big, too. You can't really miss him either,
he's
too.
Tough to miss. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would say
that is the kind of insight you can only get by being in the locker room. He is a tall human being.
Okay, let's actually get into some.
Do you remember like the first time we saw him play though, and like he went up against Al Horford, and he made Al Horford look like tiny. It was like mind blowing. I did not realize. We all knew he was a huge human being, just did not realize it until he made a 6'9" guy look tiny. Anyway, we are completely off topic.
The thing that has stood out about Joel in both of these games, in the very good win against Atlanta and the very bad loss against Cleveland, is that he has been super into moving the ball and trying to get his teammates involved. It has been just very noticeable from the beginning of the game. And he said it after the Atlanta game. They're on the road right now. Neither of us are on the road. That he was like, I want to keep the ball hopping. I want to keep these guys involved, in part because he sat with his butt on the couch like the rest of us and watched these guys cook for a week without him.
Yeah.
And, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this because it's to a pretty extreme degree, even if he's getting his shots. I'm okay with it. I support it. I think it would be hypocritical for me or us to say a couple podcasts ago, man, he scored 59 points, but it's insane how little help he had. And everybody's standing around to, you know, after last night's train wreck game, I can't believe he's trying to get everyone involved to this degree. Yeah. He's got a dunk on this team without, you know, Jared Allen playing. That's it. There is definitely a balance he has to strike because he has not been particularly sharp as a scorer, I would say, when he gets an easy ISO chance. He needs to smoke a team that doesn't have Jared Allen, who really, if Jared Allen was playing anyway, that's somebody he kills anyway. He was a good player. And he needs to be quicker on some of his moves, get his touch back, be assertive, all that good stuff. But you know what else needs to happen? And this, I thought, was very apparent in both of the games. When he goes to the dribble handoff game, the two guys on the side of the floor that he picks to run that dribble handoff on, they need to not be stationary when that happens. Yeah. It's almost like they watched him score all those ISO buckets for a few weeks and they forgot to move while he's playing now that he's back. They're watching him in awe like we are as well, where he's like, guys, come on. I want to get this thing moving. I want, you know, to get the dribble handoffs going. So it's definitely been clunky. It's very Sixers that Shake, Melton, and Tobias, at least in the second game. First game, he was very good in that Atlanta game. They've all turned into pumpkins to a degree when Embiid has come back and tried to get on the ball. And they're getting good shots as well. Like, Shake can't make a floater anymore. Melton was a disaster in the Atlanta game. Tobias was a disaster last night. They're not pumpkins, but I mean, their play has just regressed. And I think part of that is they played five games in 7 nights
I think a big part of that is.
But ultimately, I think to wrap it up here, I don't mind that it's a little clunky right now. The offense was not that great in either of these games. What I don't want to watch all year is the default offense being Joel shooting Kobe difficulty level fadeaway jumpers. And that to be like, I don't know, 40% of the team's offense with everybody standing around. Don't get me wrong. Like, he can do that when he needs to, and I'm sure he will in important possessions. But there needs to be more of a culture of ball movement and five guys playing together. And I appreciate that he's trying to do that, even if there both needs to be, I don't know, just better help from his teammates. Like, guys just understanding that he's trying to get them involved and he's trying to play the same way. And also, there needs to be times during the game where he's like, all right, I'm going to post up this guy who's way smaller than me because I'm just better than him. So yeah. That's been my big takeaway.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, like, he's averaging, what was it? It was 6.5 assists and 2.5 turnovers since coming back. Over his last 5 appearances, he's averaging 7 assists per game. He is certainly making a way more concerted effort to play that style. He's not being nearly as aggressive, including last night when he had the very obvious size mismatch. And Mobley's a fantastic defender. He's just too small, too slender. Joel could put him under the basket whenever he wanted to. Look, if that is my biggest complaint with Joel Embiid, I'll take that complaint. I think they, maybe right now in last night's game, they might not have had enough talent to make that work. And I think part of this is bad timing, because I think Melton and Milton were due for to come back down to earth a little bit. I think that's especially true when you talk about playing, like you said, 5 games in 7 nights, and big minutes in almost all of those games. They are running on tired legs. And also, they were playing above their heads for quite a while there. Those two things were going to eventually run head to head. And that probably has very little, if anything, to do with Joel Embiid's presence. Like you said, yep. I think they got pretty good shots, a lot of them, over the last 2 games. You were due for a little bit of regression. And we'll talk about that regression in a completely different way when we start talking about the defensive side of the court. But I don't want to make too much of it, because I do think long term, especially when Maxey and Harden get back, you don't need Joel Embiid. Well, I say that, but I watched the Utah game too. For the most part, you don't need Joel Embiid taking, you know, every contested fadeaway jumper. You need him to be able to do that when you need a big bucket. But I think Joel growing, because, I mean, look, teams have to double him. He realizes that. When you double, like, you are going to get good shots if you move the ball. I like him moving the ball, and I like the way he's approaching it.
Yeah, and it's not the best short-term thing for them right now, because honestly, he could have scored 40 points on that team through just sheer will. But this is the type of early season poor play or bad play that I'm willing to live with, because I don't know, man. I really dig that he has I would even call this the emotional intelligence of understanding, like, the vibes are really good with the team right now because the ball is hopping and everybody's involved. And combining that with the actual X's and O's basketball intelligence, because Joel Embiid is a really, really smart basketball player. And he understands, like, I don't want to play like Kobe's I think you would probably say Kobe's his favorite player. I don't want to play like that on a consistent basis. Like, that's not going to work in the long run. We need to have other stuff. Like, yes, can I do it on plays or for stretches of key moments? Sure. But, you know, the way you blow out teams in the regular season, the way that you score against good offense or good defenses in the playoffs, is that you make them work, you bend them. and I don't think, you know, I mentioned on the last pod, there's two ways you can be hard to guard. You either can have great individual talent, or you can have great schemes and great ball movement and all of those things. They need to get both, because when Embiid was scoring, they weren't hard to guard as a team. And, you know, I certainly think there is a balance, but I think it's cool. Like, there was a play after, I think they ran a pick and roll for Shake. Shake couldn't make a floater against Atlanta, but he did have some success with Joel in the pick and roll against Atlanta down the stretch of that game. And Shake scored. He rejected the screen and scored. And Joe was, like, fired up. Like, you know, I always hear about when he has bad body language. I thought he had great body language that entire game. And the fact that they weren't playing well, they didn't quit. They never really panicked. And I thought that was an encouraging performance. Unfortunately, it was followed up by their worst game of the year. But I guess we can gloss over that a little bit. But I don't know. I dig how he's gone about it. Like, I think that's the right thing for them long term, even if it might cost them a few points here in the short term.
Yeah, and it's sort of a shame the timing of our podcast again. I feel like the timing of our podcast are going to make this a little bit gloomier of a podcast than maybe it should be, because they played a real good game there. They completely blew out the Magic. They came back and they had a good game undermanned against the Hawks. They've been playing, you know, we've all rattled off the, you know, what was it, 9 out of 14 or whatever they've won. One game doesn't change that. And that's part of the reason why, like, mm-hmm. you know, the last two losses have been pretty discouraging losses. If you look just at them, you know, the Hornets loss and then certainly the Cavs loss, pretty discouraging, pretty disgusting, quite frankly. But when you take a step back and look at the bigger picture is trending in the right direction. And are they beating a murderer's road? No. But they're also missing two all-star, borderline all-star guards from their lineup. Like, they're having pretty encouraging performances here right now. So I don't want to kill them too bad. But we do kind of have to move on to the defensive side of the court. How, on a scale of DEFCON 1, which is like nuclear war, and DEFCON 5, which is who cares, how concerned were you with what they did defensively against the Cavs?
I always screw up the DEFCONs. Yeah. I think a lot of people think it's 5, right? That's correct. They think that's DEFCON 5 is what it is now, right? When there's not,
well, I don't know for sure. I hope so. I hope there wasn't a news event that I'm missing. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to get into geopolitics here right now, but hopefully it's DEFCON 5. But I will say I have screwed that up in my life where I've been like, oh man, this is DEFCON 5. And really, you sound like an idiot because that just means it's nothing. Where am I at? Wait, just off of last night's performance or all of this?
Well, I think all of it, you have to be pretty encouraged because before that, they were the top defense in the league for like 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah, they were the top defense in November. And I thought they were going to, there was no way that they were up by a couple points. I actually haven't checked. I will during this pod if they lost it, because it seemed hard for them to be able to lose it in the one last game. But they, I don't know. I think they might have lost it with how bad they played. I think there was some shooting regression that hit them super hard.
And that's another one. You can regress back up to the mean. It doesn't mean just going backwards. So you regress towards the mean in either direction. Just mm-hmm. to clarify that.
I knew that one. That one I've been good on the whole time. I think before last night's game, the number was 31.7% opponents shooting on threes. Now, look, there have been instances of teams over the years, whether it's Toronto, Boston, whatever, where the teams just overperform what they're shooting.
The running theory is that you leave the right shooters open and give up threes to people who you're willing to take threes.
And I think there's probably something to that, but it's not that simple because that stuff doesn't translate over every single year.
Right.
And also when, like, you know, you have teams that leave shooters wide open, like, all right, congratulations, Milwaukee, you left Grant Williams wide open in game 7 last year. He torched you. So I kind of don't think being overly reliant on that strategy is a huge deal, but you're right. You're right. That has been kind of the theory, and especially on above the break threes, that's been the working theory. Here's my point. I don't think the Sixers fit into that box. Would you agree with that?
I agree. Yeah, I would agree. There have certainly been people taking threes that you go, oh, that's a three he can make, and he's missed them. Yeah.
So, you know, 31.7 to be number one in the league. Now, sometimes teams have just the Jedi three-point defense year. The Knicks had it in that pandemic year, I'll tell you.
Yeah,
that.
But even that is usually like 2% maybe under league average. You don't usually see teams 4 or 5% under league average like the Sixers currently are.
Oh, yeah. So teams are going to start to make more shots, and unfortunately the Cavs made everything in last night's game. But the Sixers defense was bad besides that too. Like their transition defense in particular is weird. It was once Embiid left the game, which was goofy. Usually you would assume it's, you know, he's being slow, and there were some possessions where he kind of fell down. There were kind of offensive issues where he fell down on a drive, and then it's, you know, it's the classic Sixers can't stop a 5-on-4. It's a nightmare. But most of it was with Reed in the game, and Reed was scoring, but they just weren't getting back on defense when he was in there for whatever reason. I don't think it was just Reed's fault by any means. I think it was just the entire team's fault. They did a really poor job with Darius Garland. He lived in the paint. He made sprayed out passes. I would say it's like a three. I think they were playing over their heads a little bit defensively, especially with Joel out. But I think the final point on that is they don't need to be the number one defense, I don't think, when everybody's back, like, to be a really good team. Like, the top 10 will suffice, I think. That'll be okay. So they have some room for some teams to hit some threes and, it, you know, for that to come back to normal, and they'll still be okay. They need to play better transition defense. I wonder, like, are they a little tired from playing a million minutes and not having really any subs? I don't know. But their defense was really, really crappy in last night's game.
Yeah. I said this in my article. I think it's always a combination. It's a combination of bad offensive possessions, which led to run out opportunities, turnovers, bad shots, a combination of bad transition defense, and a combination of, I mean, bad, not denying dribble to penetration either, and then just uncharacteristically hot shooting. Like, it's not like Cleveland was living on corner threes. I think they only had 5 corner threes. They shot 10 for 19 above the break. I don't really care how open you are. Most teams aren't going to go 10 for 19 on those shots. So I think it was a little bit luck. But they also didn't do the little things to earn the benefit of the doubt. Like, they had a bad game defensively that was made worse by a team that was making really tough shots. And there were a bunch of, you know, there were like a bunch of Donovan Mitchell threes I thought were pretty well contested. Garland hit that one step back over Paul Reed. Like, there was some tough shots made.
That was nasty.
But then they compounded that. You know, they probably would have had a tough time to win the game anyway, but they compounded that with bad turnovers and bad transition defense. And at that point, what are you going to do? I thought what was really surprising, because then there was sort of like a fourth factor in there, they didn't really stop anyone at the rim either. Like, Cleveland shot 23 of 28 at the rim, and a lot of that was right at Joel. Like, that game started off with 3 bang-bang plays where Cleveland went right at Joe. And one of them was in transition. He tried to take a charge. I think it was Mobley, just Euro-stepped right around him. There was another one where he got beat on help, and rather than recovery, he tried to just swipe at the ball. There were a couple where they took right up at him, and he didn't impact the game defensively at the rim the way that we're used to seeing. Is that anything to be concerned of? No, probably not. Like, I still think Joel's going to protect the rim. It just all added up to one really disastrous game defensively. And am I too worried about it? No, I still worry about the transition defense, which, for the record, has been a lot better here over the last month.
It just was his game, yeah.
That game was bad. Now you bring in Harden, who's not exactly known for his transition defense. You try to meld all of this together. That still concerns me a little bit. And quite frankly, this matchup against Cleveland, when you add in, you know, Harden and Maxey, I don't know how they're going to stop them if this were a playoff series. That's just not really what happened last night. Like, it was just, what happened last night doesn't concern me too much. It was pretty much a one-off.
Speaking of three-point shooting, have you seen what Luke Kornet does for the Celtics?
No, where are you going?
When he can't get a contest, like, there will be a guy wide open in the corner, he stands under the rim, or just in front of it, and jumps 7 feet straight up in the air, just as like a visual illusion to block the shot. It's one of the goofiest things I've ever seen. He does it, it seems like, once a game. He did it to Udonis Haslam in last night's game. When I was watching, I would like to see B-Ball Paul try that. It's, I don't know. It's a very goofy.
Talk about a weird team. The best offense in the league by a mile. Like, by history. A mile.
That'd be a history they're setting, too.
Yeah, like, they're playing incredible, mediocre defense. Extending Al Horford. Like, just a weird team in every direction. Every direction.
I mean, a really good team, though. I think the clear favorites to win the NBA title.
And to be honest, like, I think we both had them as one of the two favorites to win Eastern when the season started.
I think
we just expected it to play out differently than it has been. By weird, I don't mean bad. I just mean not what we were expecting.
Completely agree. We thought it was a defensive juggernaut, not an offensive juggernaut, and it's been the opposite. The other thing that was funny about that game, because thank God the Sixers were over, so I could flip over for the end of that game. They had the Royals were sitting there. The Prince and Princess of Wales, Kate Middleton and Prince William, they were there. I don't know why they're in America. They kept panning. It was NBC Sports Boston was the feed on NBA TV. They kept panning to them after every make. They were politely clapping after every Celtics basket. Everyone. The Celtics scored 130 points last night, dude. That's a lot of polite clapping you have to do. I mean, there was a lot of buckets. Anyway, I got a major kick out of it.
Wave?
I'm sure they did.
Fancy wave?
I'm sure they did, but it was very fancy, polite clapping. And I think at one point, the camera panned on him and he said to her, he said, he's very good after like a Tatum bucket. It was, I don't know, just the idea of how polite they are and how, I don't know, how out of place they seem in a basketball game. I wish that happened in Philly when they said that about Embiid. Ooh, ooh, he's very good. Yeah. Okay. That was
proper,
I don't
good
know.
Show.
Yeah, exactly. That was the most joy I got out of basketball last night, because the Sixers, they didn't really provide too much for me. The other thing, I guess, on defense that I think we've seen a lot of is that they're playing more zone.
A lot of zone.
It's a lot. So I did you know, can you guess how much zone they're playing, like on a percentage of their
7%.
Possessions? Yeah, it's, I think it's 6.7 the last time.
It was 7% going into the Cleveland game. I only know that because I mentioned that after the Atlanta game, because they played a good chunk of the everything after the first quarter, they played a good chunk in the zone. So it was something we kind of had to look up.
It's
which,
so
according
crazy,
to Doc,
though.
They practice a lot. According to Tobias, they don't really practice at all. So who knows? But
wait, there is something I wanted to talk about with Doc. Did you see Doc call it a schedule loss after the game?
Yeah.
I saw Joe DeCamera.
It did not go over well.
Yeah, Joe DeCamera completely ripped him for about 10 minutes on his show today. Which, on the one hand, like, yeah, to call that a schedule loss that specific game, it's a little bit of a stretch, but they had played five out of seven.
It's funny because they've had a bunch of back-to-backs. The Atlanta game was on the second night of a back-to-back. The Charlotte game, which their previous loss was on the second.
That was a
real
schedule
loss. Legitimate scheduled loss, yeah. They actually had a day off there in that one, and not very far of a travel, so I agree that there was something to it, because like you said, they played 5-7. Like, that just takes a toll on you. It's also not what a lot of people want to hear.
No.
But again, they just won like 9 out of 14. So I'm not too up.
I'm not freaking out about it. I'm willing to give them a pass, but it's funny. Like, Doc lies to us. He just says shit sometimes. Like you just said with the zone stuff, you know, he said
Which
they practice zone all the time.
Was
Tobias
lying, or if Tobias was just trying to, like, I don't want to say be funny, but like, I think Tobias wasn't all that happy with their zone, and maybe he was making an excuse for it. I don't know.
I don't know, man. Tobias does not strike me as somebody who, like Doc, just says shit off the cuff. He does not strike me as that guy. He strikes me as a truth teller, I think, is how I would say it. Like, even when he's trying to lie, or he has to say like a white lie, whether it's like an injury or something like that, I feel like he tries to say it in a polite way,
now,
or he's laughing about it, whatever. It
doesn't
come as easy.
There is a way to bridge the gap, because Doc said they practice it almost every day, and Tobias said that they don't practice it very much. They could practice it for like 2 minutes a day. That would be both every day and not a lot. Could be. I'm just trying to give him an out here.
I also think Doc, one of his better...
I think Doc just says shit.
Yeah, well, definitely. And I wouldn't judge too much off of that. And I will say, I don't mind that when they get killed, and NBA teams get killed sometimes, even good ones, I do think Doc has a pretty good, I don't know, ability to brush it off. Like, hey, that happens. You know, how many games has he won? 1,000? It's really just an award for coaching for forever. He's lost a ton of them, too. You know,
yep.
So he's kind of been there, done that. Yeah, I guess back to the zone. Have you seen how much zone the Miami Heat are playing, though?
Yeah, like 16%, right?
No.
Second place was 16%.
That's
Portland. Yeah. No, it's I want to say like near 30.
32.
Okay. That's a lot. That's like unprecedented a lot for modern NBA.
That's crazy, man. Yeah. I mean, think about it. I feel like I've seen the Sixers play more zone than they've had in years. They played 6% of their possessions. Like, that's really not that much in the grand scheme of things. No. And it feels like they've played 4 or 5 games where they've strictly gone to that zone. And Doc's like, we like it. You know, it helps our guys not run and they're tired.
That was like my favorite thing ever. He was like, it allows people to stay on the court and still be there for offense. That is where I love, because Doc can be full of shit, and then he'll have like these moments of honesty. I thought that was extremely funny the way he described it. He's like, yeah, rather than resting people and getting them off the court, we'll just play a zone and they can still be on offense. It was great. It was true.
I don't know how much of it was last night's game, but their zone statistically has not been very good.
No,
they're allowing over a point. No, like, now maybe this was, you didn't look at it after last night's game where it feels like they just
Everything got worse. Yeah.
Yeah. They ran a step up ball screen for Mitchell and it was a three, even though it was kind of contested. It was rough. So we're seeing more of that. I don't really like it that much, but whatever. You got to try stuff once in a while. I don't hate the fact that they're trying it. I like that you're willing to mix it up. But as I think longtime listeners know, zone is for cowards, and I feel that way. Also, I just don't think it works in the long run. Again, I watched the Heat in that game where the Royals were clapping the entire time. Part of the reason they were clapping on every possession was the Heat were playing zone, and the Celtics were absolutely shredding it to an insane degree.
Part of Doc, he's like, we saw Atlanta play Miami the night before, and Miami went 80% zone. He's like, it's amusing to me. Like, teams have 40 plays against man and only two against zone, so we thought it would be easy to prepare against. Well, the reason that teams only have two against zone is because it doesn't take a rocket science here to figure out how to get an open shot against the zone. So, yeah, I don't enjoy using it a lot often, but on one night, like Atlanta, playing a back-to-back, got a lot of tired players, sure, bust out that zone.
Keep playing that garbage. And I think it worked decently for them over their stretch of being shorthanded, and also that Atlanta game, and then they got burnt by it. So, you know, I think it's a good thing to see the positives and the negatives. Like, for me, honestly, if you're playing zone, Sixers, Thybulle has to be in the game. Like, there's just no reason not to do it if he's not in the game, because he's actually really good at that. And, okay.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So on the topic of Matisse, PJ Tucker, offense. He's feeling a little Matisse-ish right now.
He is. And one of the things that you and I said, or at least I said, a couple weeks back when he started this epic, what, he scored 26 points, I think, in the month of November? Which they played a few games in the month of November.
I think probably
14, 15. He was on the court. Missed like a half here or there, but he was on the court. One of the things that we said when this whole thing started was, well, at least defenders are still respecting him on the perimeter. He's not Matisse because he's still spacing the floor a little bit. It's not really happening. Now, Cleveland is as aggressive as anyone, or at least anyone the Sixers have played this year, in doubling off of non-shooters. But he, at this point, and I think, what do you make? Two threes?
Mid-two. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe if he gets out of this rut, teams will go back to defending him, because he can definitely make that shot, that line drive planted shot. But right now, Cleveland came in, they're like, look, probably because they didn't feel like he would take the threes, we're going to give him that space. That was very evident pretty much all night long. And when you have two of them on the court, that's real tough. It's real tough. They need PJ. Look, PJ Tucker, we said this before, he's been real good defensively. They need him defensively. I saw this stat somewhere, so I apologize for not crediting correctly, but their defensive rating when Embiid and Tucker on floor is incredible. And I don't think that's 100% by accident. Like, PJ Tucker has played
that's not by accident.
Very good defense against a wide range of offensive players. And for him to do that at 37 is quite honestly impressive. But they've been playing 4-on-5 for a month now offensively, and they just look, he's like a career, 5 point per game scorer? You're not asking for much. You're one or two threes a night when you're open, and a garbage bucket. That's it. And then everyone shuts up, and we can go back to appreciating his defense. And he can get that cardio in.
Yeah. No, I think that's well put on the marathon man. I mean, the degree to which Cleveland did not guard him was pretty wild. I rewatched some of the first half clips. They were legion of boom clapping after defensive pass interference level with those 3 second violations. Like, I dare you to call it every time. They stuck that guy Diakite, who played for Virginia, and I didn't know was in the NBA at this point.
Yeah.
They stuck him directly under the rim and dared Tucker to just take corner threes, which, by the way, I think when we had the Embiid discussion of last night's game, I think that also probably factors into it a little bit. Like, they were shrinking the floor to a pretty insane degree when Tucker was in there. And I mentioned this before. To me, that has to turn into the Grant Williams Game 7 thing against Milwaukee. If they are leaving PJ that wide open, the Sixers need PJ to take that shot every time because over his career, that's a bad play for the defense. Like, he... Okay, you want to clap and go nuts about your 3 second violations? We're going to throw him the ball every time, and he's going to make 8 or 9 of 10 or 20 threes. Sorry, yep. 8 or 8 of 20 threes. And that's not good defense for you. So, you know, if you, last night it might have been okay considering how the Cavs were scoring on the other end of the court. But in general, like, that's not going to be a good play. And like you said, are we going to see teams start to not guard him anymore? Because that's the whole game, right? That's teams don't really guard Thibault on the perimeter that much. They do. They have guarded PJ for the most part, just because, look, he's been the corner three king for a long time, and that's the thing. I think that's part of it, right? That's one issue. I'm not concerned about him making corner threes, though. I think if the Sixers were to play Cleveland in a playoff series, and they did that in game one, I would have confidence that they would exploit that in game two.
He would eventually run him out of it.
He would make 5 or 6 corner threes, and then they'd just say, okay, we actually have to start guarding him. To me, what is most discouraging about PJ, because like you said, we're not asking for a lot. We're asking for 5 or 6 points. But he is completely lost offensively. Like, he's supposed to be a decent passer. He's supposed to be, if not a good ball handler, like, he's not stringing 4 crossovers and in and outs and behind the backs, those advanced dribble moves like his buddy Harden is doing all the time. But he's supposed to know where to go with the basketball. He's supposed to be able to take 1 or 2 dribbles and keep it moving and find the right guy and be able to think through the game. There's none of that going on right now. And frankly, over the last couple of games, he looks completely shook. Like, he looks straight up shook dribbling the basketball right now. He had a play the other night against Atlanta where he almost turned it over, putting it on the floor twice, like the loosest, goofiest dribble. I can't describe it except saying, like, it's like, what, like an 11-year-old or 12-year-old trying to dribble with their opposite hand. It was really bad. Like, they were not tight, loose. Like, D'Anthony Melton, if he was on the other team and guarding that, like, he would have stolen the ball 4 times on how loose and away from his body that dribble is. And then he threw a pass to Embiid. It was like a 10-foot entry pass. Derek, do you remember the play I'm talking about? He missed Embiid by 10 feet. This was not a hard pass to make, too. So, look, I think there's a middle ground here. Like you said, I think he should, this idea that take him out of the starting lineup, get out of here. They need him for his defense, and his point totals are not the end of the world, especially because, like you said, all you're asking for is a couple threes a game, maybe an offensive rebound. But he needs to be a confident, competent offensive player, and he's just not looking at the rim. And when he gets those opportunities, it's just not the case right now. So that's got to change.
I don't know if I have too much more to add to that. He looks like he is a little bit shook with the way he's struggled offensively. They need to get him back. And I think Harden getting back will be good for him. I think taking those threes and making them and just seeing the ball go through the basket will be good for him. But yeah, he's definitely played like he knows that he's struggling and is second-guessing himself a lot. I agree.
You're right. That's the hope, that with Harden, when he comes back, he'll get more of those corner threes because Harden is better at creating them. He's awesome at creating them, in fact. And then maybe the rest of the game, the confidence will move up. But yeah, he's a worse offensive player independent of Harden than I thought. And frankly, like, he was okay last year in Miami when they did all the ball moving and stuff like that. So this is kind of weird, honestly. I don't really understand why he's having this crisis of confidence. I don't think it should be to this degree. That's, you know, but whatever. He also, by the way, in addition to getting the marathon cardio, he likes to jump when he shoots those threes, by the way. You know, like he'll hop like 3 or 4 times, like trying to will that ball into the basket. When you have him and then you have Daniel House, who takes a step back corner three more than any player I've ever seen in my life. I mean, you have some pretty goofy corner 3-point shooters that used to play for the Houston Rockets and now play for the Philadelphia 76ers.
Look, I guess when you're... that's all you do is stay in the corner and shoot. You got to
keep those legs warm.
Got to entertain yourself. I don't know what's going on. House definitely, he step backs into some threes that he doesn't have to. It's sort of like Harden last year when he was like, I don't do catch and shoot threes. What do you mean? You need a rhythm dribble. It almost seems like he makes shots tougher just to get into a rhythm. I don't know. All right. Speaking of Harden, scheduled to come back here, on Monday is the, not scheduled, but that is a report that he's targeting a Monday return.
Unless something goes wrong, it's probably going to be Monday.
Yeah. It's
a little weird to me. They have 3 days off after that.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe they want to, you know, give him some time off after his first game back. I don't know.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's you.
Or maybe he just wants to play against his old team. I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows? I don't know. And look, that's right on the, timeline they gave, you know, they gave four, they didn't officially give it, but behind the scenes, they were like, yeah, about a month. And it was almost exactly a month. So
I'm pretty sure it was November 3rd. So yeah. Yep. Right there. And Tyrese is probably maybe a week behind him just based on timeline. Not saying that we have gotten any update to indicate that, but an initial timeline, initial reported timeline, I think would give him about another week or so. So the Sixers are getting pretty close here to back to full strength. You've got the Grizzlies here on Friday and then the Rockets on Monday. And then you might only have two or three more games without your whole assortment. So that will be, it's still crazy. We're freaking, 22 games in the season, over a quarter of the way through the season. We've seen the full group. We've seen the core four play together 5 times. It'd be great to get them back.
This Grizzlies one would be it's going to be tough, but that would be a big one to get their schedule is pretty easy after this. They could,
but for a team for a team that struggles at times getting back in transition, this could also be ugly at times.
Yeah, I'm not going to pick them to win. I'll tell you that right now. But it would be a big one if they could get it. I guess one other thing I wanted to mention from the week, just because it was awesome, the play Embiid made against Trae Young at the end of the Atlanta game. Now, Embiid at the end of that game was a monster on offense and defense, but just the cat and mouse baiting Trae Young in just a very uncharacteristic turnover in that point was just super smart basketball. And I don't think it's like I was saying earlier, I don't think he gets enough credit for how smart he is. I get that he turns the ball over sometimes and that's annoying, but I just, there's a lot of things that just come very naturally to him that I wouldn't take for granted.
Yeah. 100%. And it's the kind of play that could have looked pretty bad if he screwed it up. But he didn't, he knew how far he could recover from. And he definitely did go, because Trae Young after the game was talking about, oh man, it was a fingertip away. I think it was a little more than a fingertip. I don't think the pass was quite as there as you thought it was.
He got you.
That was a good play. And what did Embiid end up with? Like 8 points in the final minute plus that seal? He was dominant down the stretch. Dominant. And they needed every bit of it. All right. I think that is probably a pretty good place there to cut it off. Thank you, Rich, for jumping on. And we will talk to you soon. Also, if anybody has any mailbag questions, send them to mailbag@sixersbeat.com. We will do another podcast over the weekend.
See you, man.